Welcome to The Audible. I'm Stuart Mandel, joined by Bruce Feldman. Bruce, as you know, it is the greatest weekend, opening weekend in the history of college football coming up here. And we couldn't help but notice that most of the games, many of the big games, involve teams from the SEC. So we want to bring on somebody who can help us dive a little bit deeper on those SEC teams. And I think we've got that guy in Barrett Salee from Bleacher Report.
Okay, but before we get to our guest, Stu, we have some huge news of a project we've been working on for really like a couple of years, technically. Where are you going to be on Saturday night?
So, and to be fair, we did mention this on a podcast last week, but it was around the 58th minute. So we want to make sure we get this out here now while you're all still listening. I will be in L.A. For the first Saturday and for many Saturdays because the Audible is going to another medium. We're going digital. We're going video.
Yes. So we are going to embrace Facebook Live. We're going to do it a lot better than we did at SEC Media Days because we have a full-on producer. We're going to have a co-host join us.
Kristen Balboni will be our host.
And so we're excited about it. I think ultimately what we've talked about, you know, offline a lot is taking some of the stuff we do on print right after the games, on usually on Sunday and Monday in our columns, and really trying to bring that perspective to the digital audience because we feel like there's a real need for it on Saturday nights. I mean, by Saturday night, you've seen the same highlights hundreds of times, you know, but you want to discuss more about what these games mean. I know a lot of times people will kind of click on over to message boards and different places like that to try to discuss and kind of put it into context. So we're going to help you guys do that.
So the way that's going to work, again, it's on Facebook Live on the CFB on Fox Facebook account, CFB on Fox. So go and like that on Facebook now so you'll be notified when we go live. We're going to go live at least twice on Saturdays in roughly, it's not an exact time, but roughly after the 3:30 Eastern games end and after the 8 p.m. Eastern games end. But we could go live, if something merits it before that, we could go live then as well. We'll be in studio, actually borrowing the Jay and Dan studio in L.A. Usually, Kristen and myself in person and you remotely from whatever city you're doing your sideline game from, which is Morgantown, West Virginia this week. But obviously, you'll be in L.A. a few times as well, and I'll be remote a few times as well. And so we're really looking forward to it. It'll be a chance to, like you said, you know, on TV throughout the day Saturday, you get no shortage of highlights. You get many great analysts, including our own Coach Wonstedt, Matt Leinart, Robert Smith, breaking down the X's and O's. What we want to do is spin it ahead. And so the example I always use as we've pitched this over the last year is last year's Ohio State-Michigan State game, an upset that nobody saw coming that happened in the middle of the day by 11:30 Eastern. You've seen the highlights. Now it's what does this mean for the playoff race? How does this reset the playoff race? How does this affect the legacy of that team or the Heisman race? Any number of implications, obviously. That's the great thing about college football is that one game can turn the entire landscape of the sport upside down. So, again, it's The Audible on Facebook Live. It'll be going out on CFB on Fox. And obviously you and I will use our Twitter feeds to, because we know not everybody's living on Facebook on Saturdays, we will use our Twitter feeds to promote it and let you know when we're about to go live.
Sounds good. So without further ado, should we get to our guest?
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's get to our guest. You know, I'm excited to have our guest on because he has kind of an unconventional path into the media, which I felt like I did as well. So I always like to see guys like that. Always like to see people like that getting out into the mainstream more. So with that, from Bleacher Report and deep in the heart of SEC country in Atlanta, we are pleased to be joined by Barrett Salee. Barrett, thanks for joining us on The Audible today.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, Stu, I want to get into Barrett's path a little bit later, but let's get right into it. We have week one, and one of the bigger stories, and I think it's going to be this way all season, is Kirby Smart's first year, and Jacob Eason was a high-profile quarterback recruit coming in from Washington State. Barrett, what do you think is realistic for Jacob Eason and for Georgia's offense this year in year one under Kirby Smart?
I mean, I think he's going to be the primary quarterback, and they've been, it sounds like they've been preparing for him to be the number one guy kind of up until this week. And that's probably just because Grayson Lambert's going to trot out there and take the first snap. But, you know, I think he's going to be the primary quarterback, whether he's the starter in game one or whether he comes in series two or series three. And so, you know, he's going to have some ups and downs. I don't necessarily think that they have the offensive line that a lot of others do. And so he may get rattled at times. He's going to face a ton of pressure. He doesn't have weapons that I think are ultra trustworthy. I mean, Terry Godwin's pretty good. You know, Isaiah McKenzie's all right as a slot receiver, but you know, he's going to have some ups and downs, and where those ups and downs come, I think really are going to determine whether Georgia's an actual, you know, East contender or not. You know, they've certainly got the talent to contend for that division, but I can't imagine them being better than a 9-3 type football team, and really being a contender in the East determines which 9 and which 3 those actually are. You know, but again, I think for Georgia fans and the ones that I've talked to, you know, I grew up here, I've lived here my entire life, you know, it seems like the majority of the fan base, even though Mark Richt's literally got fired for going 9-3 in the regular season, you know, they're kind of content being 9-3 if it's 9-3 with Jacob Eason, knowing that 2017 could be a pretty big year.
Yeah, isn't that great how fan expectation works?
Right.
If it wasn't good enough for one guy, I think even if he goes 8-4, if they are promising and Jacob Eason's promising, I mean, everybody just kind of looks at this as a, you know, as a transition to 2017 when Kirby's had a more of a chance to establish himself. In terms of this North Carolina game, I don't know how to read. This is one of the more intriguing matchups because on the one hand, you would say, well, you know, look what Baylor did in the bowl game. Just you got Nick Chubb, just line up, run it, hand it off to him and run it down North Carolina's throat. But like you said, I don't know that it's a given that Georgia has the offensive line to do that this year. And if they don't, can, you know, most likely the freshman quarterback step up and take advantage?
Yeah, I mean that's the biggest concern. I'm actually covering this game. I do all the games and do so in part to the free Chick-fil-A sandwiches, of course. But you know, it's kind of odd because I don't think they necessarily trust their offensive line. I know Kirby Smart doesn't trust his defensive line either. So, you know, it's one of those things where you could be getting into a shootout if Nick Chubb and really to a lesser extent Brendan Douglas and some of the other guys, you know, don't control the clock and keep North Carolina's offense on the sidelines, because I don't think they feel like Grayson Lambert can win a shootout, and they don't really want Jacob Eason to get into a shootout in game one. So it really does fall on Nick Chubb. It does fall on his ability to, you know, I wouldn't say necessarily be the 30 carries a game back that he was before the injury, but he may have to tote it 25 times and hope that Brendan Douglas and some of those other guys can pick up that slack. And it's going to be fascinating, because if this game gets sideways or the quarterback, whoever it is, makes some mistakes, or there's, you know, a game changing fumble, you know, North Carolina can put, you know, play point a minute football. And that's the last thing that Georgia needs at this point.
You know, you guys got me excited about this game. It's been kind of a little bit overlooked with all the other ones that people have talked about. But just the idea of the other team has a terrific running back in Elijah Hood, and he's going up against a largely rebuilt front seven. So that's going to be worth keeping an eye on. Let's move over to another team that has a quarterback issue. All right, Barrett, I am on the Brandon Harris bandwagon. I will admit that I've been on the Brandon Harris for a while. I'm a little biased because I like Brandon as a kid. I've known him for a while. But I think he's very talented. It's year three. I don't know if Stu's believing yet. Are you believing in him, and are you believing in LSU?
I believe Brandon Harris is a really good quarterback in an awful spot, in an awful system for himself. I think a lot of focus is on, you know, Brandon Harris turning things around. And I don't think Brandon Harris is in a position where Brandon Harris can turn things around. I don't think Les Miles has changed his offensive philosophy. I don't think Les Miles ever will change his offensive philosophy. And so I don't think LSU can really do much of anything this year. I think it's the same exact team as last year. They've got a great defense. We'll see how they transition to a 3-4. They've got a great running back. But they cannot win games, and they've proven they can't win games outside of their comfort zone. And that's, you know, Brandon Harris takes the brunt of the criticism for that, but it's not really his fault. That's on Les Miles. And, you know, he has not adjusted like a Nick Saban. Nick Saban won a national championship playing Clemson football because he's smart enough to go out there and hire Lane Kiffin. He won an Iron Bowl in 2014 over Auburn, playing Auburn football. He's, you know, cranked up the tempo. He's understood in the West Virginia game in 2014 in the second quarter, I need to go hurry up no huddle with Blake Sims because that's what he does well. Les Miles, like, that's not even a thought process with him. So until Les proves that he can do that, I don't think LSU is any different than they were last year, whereas I think a team like Texas A&M and even a team like Auburn have actually addressed their issues in the SEC West and will leapfrog LSU. I picked LSU to go 8-4 and 4-4 in the conference. I just don't think they're much of a contender because of their head coach.
Wow, Bruce, that really runs contrary to both of us since I have LSU in the playoff. But I've always felt a little gun-shy about it because I am putting so much faith in Brandon Harris and that offensive system. So if that is the case, Barrett, if you've got those other teams going ahead of LSU, I mean, I'll start with A&M. They've obviously got a big opener against UCLA. It sounds like you feel that talent-wise, they're, first of all, in the same ballpark as LSU, and that you just have more faith in Trevor Knight to come in and lead that team than what LSU is going to try to do.
Yeah, I do for a couple of reasons. One, you know, I think that from a talent standpoint, they're pretty close. And getting, you know, guys back like Ataro Alaka, linebacker, will help their run defense. They were really good in pass D last year, second best in the SEC. Obviously, you know, another year with Mack and Miles Garrett and Deshaun Hall will help. Having Daylon Mack with a full year and a strength and conditioning program, I think, will help him tremendously. And then they addressed their issues. They went out and got one of the best graduate transfer quarterbacks on the market in Trevor Knight. Now, Trevor Knight, you know, has had his ups and downs, but, you know, he's not going to be asked to go win a ton of football games. I think with Noel Mazzone, you know, they're going to do what Kevin Sumlin told me he wanted to do all offseason last offseason when he said he wants to run when he needs to, not just when he wants to. And it seemed like last year, Jake Spavital took that part of the playbook, ripped it out, set it on fire, and didn't think about it ever the entire season. And that's what Noel Mazzone has been doing for years out on the West Coast, a tempo-based spread power rushing attack. So I think they've got the guys that can do that. Keith Ford being eligible if he can stay healthy after transferring from Oklahoma is a pretty dangerous kid. I like James White a lot. A couple of the freshmen they've got coming in, I think they can trust to be change-up backs out of the backfield. So I think they've addressed their issues well. And I think that will lead them to contention in the SEC West. Now, the one thing with Texas A&M also is that if they lose the opener to UCLA and they do lose in week three to Auburn, it can go south in a hurry too. You know, I that's one of the more volatile teams, I think, in the entire country. You know, they can contend for an awful lot. They can also be out of it before the leaves change color if they're not careful.
Yeah, let's talk about another team that I think could go south in a hurry, and that is the Auburn Tigers. They have a big, big opener at home against Clemson, who's loaded on offense and got some pieces to put back together on defense. Do you think Gus Malzahn will be the head coach of the Auburn Tigers in 2017?
Yeah, I do. I had them 8-4, which, I mean, if you're at 8-4, it sort of depends on how the 8 look and how the 4 look. But I think that the thing about Auburn last year, they were in essentially every game other than the LSU game with a third string running back being the primary running back due to injury, with Rock Thomas and Javon Robinson both being banged up. Peyton Barber was their third stringer until halftime of the Louisville game. And literally no threat at quarterback, and with an awful defense for 2 months out of the season. But when Carl Lawson came back, they actually were really good defensively, 339 yards per game over the final five games of the season. And they get Carl Lawson back. They love Marlon Davidson, the true freshman kid. They have depth for days on a defensive line. And then I think they feel very confident that Kevin Steele has simplified a defense that is very complicated under Will Muschamp and was very complicated for Will Muschamp. So I think defensively they'll be significantly better, the best they've been at any point during Malzahn's tenure as a head coach or a coordinator at Auburn. And offensively, yeah, there are questions. But, you know, losing Javon Robinson is not great. But you can criticize Gus Malzahn for a lot of different things. Development of quarterback, time management, all that is 100% valid. The one thing you can't criticize him for is developing a running game, because he's done it everywhere he's gone in a variety of different ways with a variety of different players, including some on the fly, like last year when Rock Thomas and Javon Robinson both got hurt in the first half against Louisville. So, you know, they'll be able to run the football. And the one thing I've kind of gathered from talking to the coaches there is that while, you know, Sean White's not plan A, they brought John Franklin in to be the guy. He hasn't been, you know, consistent enough through the air to be the guy. At the same time, they also feel a lot more comfortable with plan B in Sean White than they were last year and maybe thought they'd be at the start of fall camp in August. So to me, that team's going to be really good defensively. They're going to be really good on the ground, and they'll be certainly better through the air. And that, to me, equals a couple of a bump in the win total to 8-4 type team. I think they're going to be pretty competitive in every game. And still, 8-4 for them, it depends on how the 8 look. It depends on how the 4 look. But most likely that keeps Gus Malzahn around.
I got to tell you, after watching Last Chance U, I'm not really surprised John Franklin III did not end up winning the Auburn starting quarterback job, seeing as he never did beat out the guy who
was a walk-on at Mississippi State
last year. Although he did have that sizzling first half at the end of the in the last game they show. I'm sorry, I'm giving all these spoilers for that documentary.
Well, yeah, but that was a little misleading though, because I did a feature on Franklin though, and the documentary, while it was awesome and very insightful in junior college, it made it sound like Franklin played 2 games and then sat until Rhett Lashley showed up and then came in for an injured Wyatt Roberts, and no one there says that's how that went down. Like, he played every single game, he played a significant role, and the plan all along in that final game was for him to play a lot because Rhett Lashley was leaving at halftime to go to Fayetteville, Arkansas to coach in that game in late October. So that was a little miss. But look, I mean, it's Hollywood. They needed an antagonist. And, you know, it made for great TV, that's for sure.
That actually makes a lot more sense. That actually explains why they were – well, now I'd be giving away too many plot points, so I won't even go there. I was going
to
say why –
Stick
why
to our scripts.
Why you put him back script. In the game at the end of the first half. I just watched the last part last night. That's why this is – fresh in my mind.
It's really good. I mean, it's a really well done documentary, and next year is going to be even better because DeAndre Johnson's there and we all know his story.
All right, so I was just going to say it's amazing that we've been talking about the SEC this long and not mentioned Alabama. They play USC, obviously. I had a mailbag, that was the lead of my mailbag on Wednesday, a very optimistic USC fan questioning the national assumption that this game's going to be a blowout. I will stick to that prediction, but if this is the season that the Alabama run ends, which I guess would just mean losing 3 or 4 games, what will have gone wrong for Nick Saban's team?
This is so not sexy, but it's the truth. It's the center position, because
I think that's a great point.
I mean, not only is Ryan Kelly gone, how many centers get drafted in the first round? I mean, every time Ryan Kelly went out for the last 3 years, the Kick 6 game, the Ole Miss game 2 years ago, the Arkansas game when they won 14-13 2 years ago, it's like red flags went up. But not only did they lose Ryan Kelly, everyone thought Ross Pierce-Baker would be the guy moving over from guard, and then suddenly Saban throws a curveball game week and says, oh, no, it's Bozeman. So you have a new center, you have new quarterback, you have running backs who really don't have experience in pass pro, going up against, it's a, you know, unsettled front seven at USC, a really talented front seven at USC. That to me could spell trouble for this game and be the reason it's close. And it could be problematic for Alabama all season long, because, you know, Lane is a great offensive coordinator. He gets mismatches before the line of scrimmage. He does all the things well that offense needs. The one thing you can't do is call out protection schemes at the line of scrimmage. The center needs to do that, and he needs to be on the same page as the quarterback, and the running back needs to be on the same page too, and all three of those people are new, and that's scary.
On top of that, the O-line coach is new as well.
That's true.
coming from UCF. Barrett, I want to ask you just a little bit. How did you get into this? Because I know that obviously you grew up in Georgia, and we've seen a lot. You know, Bleacher Report brand has grown significantly in the last few years, especially. You know, now there's a big Notre Dame project that, you know, we're all going to probably see a lot of. Mm-hmm. How did you get into this, into the business and into the media?
Well, I majored in radio, TV, and film in college. I worked in sports information in college. And when I moved back, I worked in regional television at Fox Sports Net South, doing the old, if you remember back in the early 2000s, the Southern Sports Reports, the Arizona Sports Reports, all the regional sports reports on Fox Sports South. Or Fox Sports Net. I worked for about 3.5 years doing those for the Southern Sports Report, and then they also did our Arizona shows out of our Atlanta studios, which was not good for time changes because that means getting home at 4 o'clock in the morning when you did Arizona stuff. So did that for a while, and then did some other stuff in the sports media or sports business for a couple of years before getting back into radio in the Southeast, and then worked at College Football News with Few Tech for 4 years before getting hired at BR when they started hiring lead writers back in 2012. This is the second wave after they hired a group of five guys full time. They hired about 20 more full time writers, and I was one of those back in 2012. And since then, I've been doing SEC from a text perspective, national college football from a video perspective, and then when we did the BR radio deal, gosh, 3 years ago now for SiriusXM. SiriusXM stuff for 3 years too. So, BR was at a different place when I started, and now, the Notre Dame project, the radio stuff, the video stuff that we've been doing for a while now is just, seems to be getting bigger and bigger.
The radio in particular, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have SiriusXM, listen to SiriusXM. I've noticed you're kind of all over it, and I'm curious. You know, like we do this podcast, it basically takes up 2 hours of our week, but, you know, there's preparation as well. How do you have time for everything you just described?
Coffee helps. Luckily, my role from a text perspective has changed. We're not doing as much quantity stuff as we are, you know, quality, longer form, more analysis, more in-depth stuff from a text perspective. So that has freed me up to do a little more radio, both on BR Radio and then also on College Sports Nation. It's a balancing act that makes me always pay attention to what my iCalendar has for me, because it is hard to balance all of it. But luckily, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I do video at home. We've got a studio here for video. I do radio at home, so we do radio here. I work at home unless I'm out somewhere, and typically it's, you know, I've got video responsibilities on Saturdays. So, you know, usually I go out to a game half the time, and usually it's Atlanta, Athens, or Auburn, which is really easy for me, and no matter what. So it's not as challenging as it sometimes seems. You know, sometimes I just have to remember to eat breakfast or eat lunch or, you know, go pick up my son at school and all that stuff. So it's a lot of juggling, that's for sure.
When you were, did you go to University of Georgia? And where did you end up at?
No, I went to Auburn. My family grew up Auburn fans, but I honestly went to games as a fan at Auburn, Georgia, Alabama, like just random games, just growing up in high school. So I kind of had a full taste of the SEC before, you know, even really deciding on where to go. I've kind of been all over the place.
So, and did you work in sports information at Auburn as well?
Yes.
So, I mean, back then, did you look at where you are now? Is this is the dream job kind of setup, I would imagine, going to be, you know, a kid who grew up in deep in the heart of football country as a big fan of it, and now you get to cover it. I mean, is that what you hoped it would be when you went to college?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of wanted to do just TV in college, but the one thing, and this is back in like 2000. I mean, I'm dating myself. I'm 36 now. But you know, the one thing in one class, it was an electronic news media class. I forget exactly what it's called, but this is back then. They called it convergence. That you're going to have to be in sports media You're going to have to evolve with what they called convergence back then, which is that writers become video analysts on TV and radio hosts become writers, and all of those things are going to blend together. And that really has happened. And that was the biggest thing that I remember thinking, okay, well, if I'm going to be in that industry, I can't just focus on, at the time, what I wanted to do was TV. I need to start writing. So I started writing a little bit for, the game day program and things like that. Started doing some radio after that, got into TV, but still kept writing a little bit on the side with some other folks, just, when the blog age started, just on the side. So that was the one thing that always stuck with me, that you always have to be sort of a jack of all trades. And then now at BR now, it sort of all just kind of fell into it all sort of came together because, got the job from CFN and at BR and instantly said, you're going to do a lot of video. So there's the TV element on top of writing. And then, a couple years later, we get to deal with Sirius XM and here's radio. So that was always something that I always tried to keep in the back of my mind, prepare for, and always, try to strive for. And here it is. And I think everybody, like you guys, know this too. I mean, Bruce, you do TV, radio, and writing. Stuart, you do the same as well. I mean, it's, you kind of have to do that these days. And I think that was the one lesson I remember more than anything else in college.
Yeah, I mean, that came to be absolutely true. In 2016, you can't be just a writer. Very few people can get away with that at this point. But I also want to say, Bruce, you build this at the beginning. You build it like he was going to come out and say that he was like a Starbucks barista who randomly got tapped to start writing about college football. It's actually, you did all the things, that you're supposed to do, yeah. And from college on everybody's path is unique, but I don't think it was
traditional newspaper route that made it different.
That's true. And I think that's important for people to realize that. I was thinking about that the other day, how when I was coming out of college in 98, it was just kind of, I don't know, maybe it was a Northwestern thing. They ingrained it into you. Like, there is only one way to get to the New York Times or Sports Illustrated or right. whatnot, and that is to go out and cover sports for a small town paper, then work your way up to a slightly less small paper, and so on. And I don't think people realize that it's, that works for some people, but, it's almost better to, kind of like your job you were describing, Barrett, at Fox Local, like, just kind of get in as a gopher somewhere national. And just show them, I just think it's more effective to, and this is kind of what I did, get your foot in the door and show them what you can do kind of on the side to your regular duties, rather than, sending a blind resume every so often to some editor at a major paper or site or whatnot, and hoping they'll, open the letter and then read it and then give you a call.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing is and people always say this in every line of business is dress for the job you want, not for the one you have. And I think in media, you have to always sort of dress for the job you want, not for the one you have. And I'm not talking about myself, who for the most part wears gym shorts and a T-shirt all day long, and that's on good days. Always prepare for what you want to do and be doing what you want to do 10, 15, 20 years down the road. However you can, and there always are ways to do that. There, no matter what you're doing in media, there's always ways to prepare and do what you want to eventually do. You just have to find the right avenues to do it and be creative sometimes in how you go about it.
I'm all mentally twisted in your dress what you want to do, and I'm thinking, as soon as I thought of that, I was like, I got my guy Andy Staples in my head, and I'm like, I don't know what job that is where you wear red pants and so... but it, the cool thing about it is it kind of affords kind of all paths in there if you work hard. And, obviously that if people who follow you on Twitter know you do. By the way, Stu, I don't know if you know this about Barrett. He is probably the biggest fan of what Fox FS1 puts on our air some Saturday nights in the football season. It's like, I will occasionally, make small talk with our buddy Jenny Taft about it, but Barrett is like, he's the real deal. He really is into
the Supercross and Motocross. Every single weekend on FS1, I long story short, I used to race motocross very, very amateurly. For those that know the sport, I'm the same age as Ricky Carmichael and raced a bunch of amateur races with him. And with him, I mean, I watched him drive fastly away and then lap me about two laps later. But I used to race. I raced in the Georgia Dome in 1996 in amateur day. I've been to every Atlanta Supercross since I was born, except for two. And I watch it every single night on Saturday night in the off season on FS1. Like it is. And, our friend Ryan McGee, who works at ESPN, I still hold a grudge because out in Pasadena, when I was covering the Florida State Auburn national title game, was the season opener in Anaheim, and Ryan's flight got delayed from Bristol, and he was going to meet me at the Big A to watch the season opener, and he let me down, and I still will never let him hear the end of that.
2 years ago, covering the Sugar Bowl, Ohio State Alabama Sugar Bowl, Jenny mm-hmm. Jenny Taft, who's the is she considered a sideline reporter for motocross?
Yes.
Or, yeah. Okay. She was there with us for the hits we were doing, and I remember at a bar asking her to explain to me exactly how it works, the circuit, all of that. Yes, we have a very devoted fan base for that. Of course, Jenny is being stolen away this year by college football. She will be back being a college football sideline reporter this season, starting, I believe, with Arizona BYU.
Will she be back for January, though? Because I don't think we can survive without her getting the lowdown from guys like Ryan Dungey and James Stewart.
I assume so. I mean, calendar works out pretty much perfectly for that, but I should probably have asked her before we blurted this out on the podcast.
Into the mix.
Breaking media news.
Well, Barrett, we can't thank you enough for coming on and getting us. Like you said, Bruce, like once you start talking about it, you realize, wait a minute, Georgia, North Carolina, that's a really good game. But then so is Clemson, Auburn. So is Texas A&M, UCLA. So that's why this really is the best opening weekend in the history of the sport.
It's like A&M UCLA is fascinating too, because like literally, you know, throw out week two because of Prairie View. Kevin Sumlin has literally one chance to impress the home crowd before mid-October, and by that point it might be too late. So like it's a huge game too.
Lots and lots to like. Well, Barrett, hopefully we'll see you down the road, and again we encourage people to follow you on Twitter as well, and check out your stuff on Bleacher Report in all mediums that you're so active in now.
Anytime, guys, and I promise I will eat your share of Chick-fil-A sandwiches on Saturday for you.
Yeah, please do. We will not have that opportunity.
I will.
All right. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, Stu, it's that time again. Let's get to the mailbag. We have, I think, an interesting one to start. It is related to our last podcast guest from a couple of days ago, who kind of blindsided us with a little bit of stuff.
Yeah, you think Joel made a little bit of news with his comments on the last podcast?
Yeah, a couple of times. So let's go to @Jay@Colgate's question.
@Jay Colgate is his
name. @Jay Colgate, I'm sorry, yes. Not reading well. While I appreciate Klatt's takedown of Tebow Mania, I have an issue with him. Uh-oh. All offseason, he's been yapping about USC's D-line, even calling it a, quote, wet napkin, end quote, at one point. Is it fair of the media to be calling out USC's D-line? They're young, but they're talented and played last season. On top of that, SC brought in a 25-year-old grad transfer nose tackle from Utah and a junior college defensive tackle. They're also flipping a fifth-year guard to the D-line. That's three big mature bodies to team up with a bunch of sophomores, 4- and 5-star players, plus Clancy Pendergrass hardly plays more than two big guys during the Pac-12 season. Thanks, fight on, and Tebow sucks.
Ouch. The pile-on just continues with Tebow.
Yeah.
Well, I'll probably just throw that right back to you because you've been out there, you've seen these guys practice, but I will say that Clay Helton has not, you know, denied the fact that defensive line is by far their biggest question mark on this team. And, you know, guys can develop over the course of the season, but as I wrote about in the mailbag, that's not an ideal weak link to have when you're playing Alabama the first week of the season.
No, it's not. And also, you know, the new D-line coach, Kenichi Udizi, you know, who's a former terrific player at USC, but he's a young position coach. I did really like the hire of Clancy Pendergast, bringing him back. But the reality is a lot of these guys haven't played, and they haven't played together much. And the guy who flipped over Khalil Rogers, if they really thought he was a difference maker D-line guy, he would have been over there before. But I think you know, he's a serviceable interior lineman who, like he said, they needed a big body, so they moved him over there. I mean, the grad transfer at Utah, he did play, but I don't think he was he was not expected to start at Utah. So, you know, let's not, you know, it's not like they have Leonard Williams up there. Yeah, they have some high profile former recruits, but that's a little different than being thrown into the middle of a game against Alabama. And it did hurt him. I mean, look, Kenny Bigelow was a 5-star former recruit. It wasn't like he was playing like Leonard Williams. I mean, some of these guys have not lived up to it yet or have not done it. I mean, you look at USC's roster. I mean, it's loaded with 4- and 5-star guys, and the majority of them haven't played that way, to be honest.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a, you know, everybody obviously looks to the new coordinator hire as a salvation, but, you know, USC's defense was terrible last year. You know, specifically the Pac-12 championship game comes to mind, and so, yes, bringing in Clancy Pendergast, that will shake things up, that should change things for the better, but a defense doesn't play like that if, you know, it's still about the players, and clearly they didn't have the players last year, and so how much of an improvement can he make in 1 year's time? We're going to see. I'm going to throw you a curveball here that I did not have this email in the included in the document I sent you, but
throw it.
It's a good throw one, it. And it's related to what we just talked about. Brian Smith from Rock Hill, South Carolina. Hey, guys, I heard a question on your last pod about deciding who the great coordinators are. I root for Clemson, and since Dabo Swinney is more of a CEO-type coach, it seems like his success is in part tied to his coordinator hires. What coaches do you think have done the best and worst with coordinator hires in recent years? My suggestions for best, Dabo Swinney and bringing on Brent Venables and Chad Morris, and Bob Stoops for hiring Lincoln Riley, and the worst, Gus Malzahn for hiring Will Muschamp and Kevin Steele and Frank Beamer for hiring Scott Leffler.
Yeah, it's funny. I think Scott Leffler's at BC now, and there is enthusiasm for him there. And you talk to some people who have Michigan ties, and they think very highly of him. Sometimes beauty is in the eye of the beholder. The hires, I've been very high on this offseason. There's really three defensive coordinator hires I loved. Two of them are UMass guys, former UMass guys. Don Brown at Michigan, Bob Shoup at Tennessee, and Dave Aranda is the other guy who came from Wisconsin to LSU. Stu, what do you think is the worst coordinator fit you've seen in the last few years?
Well, first of all, his question was like, what head coaches have made the best or worst coordinator hires over the last few years? And I thought you were going to go with that when you mentioned Don Brown. Is I got to say that Jim Harbaugh's done a great job of that. If you go back to his staffs at Stanford, those guys are everywhere now. Now, you never know, did Harbaugh, you know, is it the Harbaugh blessing or whatever that caused them to go on that trajectory or vice versa? But, you know, I think he's done a very good job with his coordinator hires. Urban Meyer, it's interesting. I mean, he had no previous ties to Tom Herman when he hired him when he got to Ohio State. And, you know, I think we can all agree that worked out tremendously. But then sometimes the hires he makes to replace them are a little, you know, we'll see how it works out here. But, you know, bringing in Tim Beck from Nebraska, where the Nebraska fans were pretty sour on him to begin with, is a little odd. You know, in Florida, Dan Mullen was his guy, and Mullen coached Tebow and whatnot, and moved on to Mississippi State, and then he promoted
up Steve Adazio. That did not go well.
So
that did not work.
I think it just shows how hard this is. You know, he mentions Bob Stoops and hiring Lincoln Riley, and that was a great hire, but he had to hire him because he had just fired his Josh own Heupel. Handpicked guys, Josh Heupel, who played for him. You know, before that, it's always been unclear whether the Brent Venables to Clemson was completely mutual or whatnot, but you know, he brought his brother back because the defense hadn't been performing well. So, you miss.
I think one of the things that we probably could throw out is, you know, Lincoln Riley to me was not I don't think that's a surprise good hire. You know, some of these guys had success. The ones that I think are the ones that are the most interesting are, and I'm going to give Leach credit for this. He's not an offensive guy, but he made a really good hire last year on his defensive coordinator and Alex Grinch, who really hadn't been a defensive coordinator. And that's the part where I think, you know, you're putting your chips on the table where you've gotten a guy. I mean, you know, I would look at where you take a guy, and Doug Meacham fits in this category. He was basically a tackles and tight ends coach at Oklahoma State. He was a former Oklahoma offensive lineman. He got to Houston. You know, Tony Levine is not still the guy there, but that hire worked out really well, and it obviously worked out exceedingly well for TCU, for Gary Patterson. When you take a guy who has not been in that role and you elevate him, I mean, it's a roll of the dice, and sometimes it works. I mean, look, the same thing. Tony Levine had I think it's Eric Bush. I'm trying to remember Bush's first name. That hire and his OC before that didn't work out, where it was the guy was there for basically one game. He was elevated, didn't work. I mean, he had David Gibbs as a defensive coordinator. He brought him back, and that worked out really well. But I think it is that to me, those are the ones that are the most interesting things. When you take guys who have not been in the role, and then, or you take them from, you know, lower level football and bring them up and see how it works out.
So there's a few examples of that going into this season where these guys will kind of be on the, you know, we'll see if these decisions turn out to be great ones by the head coaches. The one that comes to mind immediately is that Charlie Strong is basically putting his eggs all in the basket of a guy, Sterling Gilbert, who is a young guy who is basically an Art Briles, you know, a devotee of the Art Briles offense, but didn't really work with him at any point, other than, like, I think as a GA, and has never called plays before, and he will be the Texas offensive coordinator this season.
And Charlie, and unlike some of these where, like, DeMonte Cross gets promoted up, he was at TCU under Patterson, and he's had been an NFL coach, but DeMonte Cross is going to work for a guy in Barry Odom who he knows really well, and Barry Odom, you know, was a defensive coordinator. And what you're talking about, Charlie Strong, he's a defensive guy.
Right.
So it's live or die with Sterling Gilbert.
James Franklin is bringing in Joe Moorhead, who is the head coach at Fordham, to be the offensive coordinator. Now, that's not a case of he doesn't have the experience. You know, obviously he's been a head coach, but I would say that's pretty unconventional, and if it works, great. And if not, people are going to say, what was he thinking? And then here's a really under-the-radar one, but one that caught my eye in the spring. Chris Ash, you know, first-time head coach at Rutgers, comes from Urban Meyer's staff most recently, Brett Bielema before that. He hired Drew Meringer as his offensive coordinator. He's 28 years old, and he was most recently the Houston wide receivers coach under Tom Herman, and that's the connection there.
Yeah, Tom Herman has told people about him for years, so this, you know, is his chance.
Yeah, he's given him the chance. Not obviously at, like, not necessarily at a glamour program. It's at Rutgers, but he's a Big Ten offensive coordinator at 28, and not a guy that he's necessarily worked with before. Getting back to what you asked initially about the worst head coach, I'm guessing you had somebody in mind, and I'm wondering if it's this, because I gotta say it was Muschamp Charlie Weiss at Florida.
Yeah, that was a really bad fit. Muschamp had a couple of bad fits there also, where his O-line guy and his offensive coordinator did not get along, and that's disastrous. I mean, that ultimately might have been his undoing at UF more than anything else.
All right. Sorry to go on that tangent there, but I thought that was a good email.
All right, so it's my turn now. Here we go. I'm not even going to read the name they called you on this. Let's just say it's probably a friend of Teddy Greenstein's. Stu and Bruce, love the pod. I never miss an episode. On the most recent episode, you guys started talking about a topic I know quite a bit about, infectious disease. Washing your hands and avoiding sick people, by far the most effective way to avoid disease. Second to that, keeping up to date with vaccinations and getting your seasonal flu shot will keep the most dangerous pathogens at bay. Fruit sure tastes good. Second, while Stu may be a West Coast superstar who can afford to keep his baby at home indefinitely, most people with jobs end up putting their kids in daycare. I mention this because I live in San Francisco, and the parent shaming that goes on for people who, gasp, can't afford night nurses, $100,000 a year preschool, and solar-powered strollers is intense. I love the entertaining personal anecdotes, and I still think it's hilarious that Bruce recorded an episode while hiking with his kids. But perhaps cool on the parenting advice for rich white people.
I mean, ouch, right? Like, I read that and said, ouch. I will take that under advisement, though. I would just say that if he lives in San Francisco, he realizes that daycare is in itself very expensive. There is no such thing as cheap childcare unless you have the good fortune to have a
relative.
Have your mom, the grandparents, sister-in-law, whoever, living right there, able to do it for free. I mean, you send your kids to daycare, and I'm assuming you're not doing it for free.
No, we're not. By the way, it's interesting how when you have kids, you find you bond with a lot of different people over different things. Having multiples, Mike Bobo and I became buddies because they have triplets, and I remember just kind of in astonishment listening to the stories of, you know, how you juggle that. So
I recently had a conversation with one of our colleagues about strollers. So there you go.
Wonstedt?
Yeah, Wonstedt for sure. We did have one more football question to get to. Bruce and Stu, I love the pod and appreciate the bi-weekly college football updates. As a diehard TCU fan, I'm having a hard time reconciling your two viewpoints on the Frogs. Stu has them ranked higher than virtually anyone at number 6, while Bruce has them finishing 3rd in the Big 12 with a conference record of 5-4. I consider myself unusually realistic when it comes to my team's expectations and believe they deserve a ranking somewhere in between. So, Stu, why are you drinking so much purple Kool-Aid? And Bruce, have you considered that TCU hasn't lost at home since November of 2013 and that they only have 3 total losses in the last 2 years? Yeah, Bruce, what are you thinking?
You know, I just think there's going to be a ton of parity in this conference. I think Oklahoma, to me, is the best team, and I think there's probably like 4 teams. I don't think there's a big gap between Oklahoma State and TCU, honestly. You know, if Baylor is able to stay healthy, I know you're more down on Baylor than I am, but I think Baylor still has a lot of speed. I mean, I think Gary Patterson's a terrific coach, but I think they're about an 8-4, 9-3 team. I don't know. I just not all on board. I mean, I think when you lose a great player like they had in Trevon Boykin and a great receiver and a go-to guy in Josh Doctson, in a conference like that, and I think the margin for error is just not that significant. Whereas I look at Oklahoma and I think Baker Mayfield, to me, can solve a lot of problems. You know, I'm not sure I see that in TCU with Kenny Hill at this point.
So and as far as my perspective, yes, I realize I'm kind of out on an island with TCU. I haven't seen many other people pick them to be in the playoff. But first of all, just when it comes to preseason predictions, I think it's kind of a cop-out if you say my 4 teams are Florida State, Clemson, Alabama, and Oklahoma. Everybody says that they have theirs 4 teams. And of course, there's no chance that the 4 actual playoff teams will be the top 4 teams in the preseason rankings. So I feel like you should go out on a limb with at least one of them. And frankly, that's probably not even as big a limb as whoever it'll turn out to be. And you're going to swing and you're going to miss like I did with Texas A&M last year. But I just think that it's worth, you know, trying to identify who's going to be that playoff team that nobody saw coming. And I also don't think it's, like you said, TCU is 23-3 the last 2 years. It's not exactly an outlandish idea that they would win the Big 12 this year. Yes, Trevon Boykin and Josh Doctson, losing them is a big deal, but you know, it's not like they're starting a true freshman quarterback here. Kenny Hill has played at the highest level. He had an up and down, and literally up and then down season when he was the starter at A&M and eventually lost his job. I just have a lot of faith after watching what Meacham and Cumbie did with Trevon Boykin, who, if you remember, was a very average quarterback who they at times moved to receiver his first 2 years. Seeing what they did with him, I believe they'll do great things with Kenny Hill. And then more importantly, Gary Patterson always has a really good defense. He did not last year, in part because they were so decimated by injuries. I think they'll go back to being one of, if not the best defense in the conference this year.
Okay. I like your Kool-Aid, Stu.
Yes.
Can't wait to get to week 1. It is almost here. We're going to check us out on Facebook Live. Hopefully we won't have any technical glitches.
Speaking of Facebook Live, somebody asked about, since we did mention it last time, somebody who was nice enough to listen to all the way to the end of the podcast asked us this. This is Aaron, whose Twitter handle is @SaundersSports. What percent of your Facebook Live audience do you expect to be stone sober in week 1? I'm setting the over-under at 12% and taking the under. Hadn't really thought about that. Midnight Eastern or 11:30 Eastern, whenever we go live, could be some people could have been going at it for quite a while by then.
Hey, I don't care as long as you have it on. I don't care if you mute us. Just look at the pictures.
It's even drunk people are on their phones at late at night. In fact, many times they're more so on their phones. And, you know, it's just going to be an interesting experiment. This is a relatively new technology, but media companies have really embraced it. I mean, you were on a Facebook Live show the other night with at Joel's show that he's going to be doing every week on Tuesdays. And we just think that, you know, you've just watched the big games. You're wanting to know, you want to talk about it with your friends. You want to know what's happening. And oh, by the way, you're gonna be on Facebook and Twitter anyway. Guess what just popped in? So please
join us
week one, especially with all the big games Saturday. There's gonna be so much to talk about by Saturday night.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on the Audible, Stu. Why don't you say the rest of the stuff you always say?
Send your emails to theaudiblepod@gmail.com. As always, if you enjoy our podcasts, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, and please leave us a review. I happened to be reading through them the other day, and there was somebody who left one of the most recent reviews who said that they enjoy the podcast and that they enjoy your sense of humor, Bruce, and then said to me, "Don't worry about trying to be funny. Bruce has got you covered."
I think that must be our buddy Rob Stone.
I just can't imagine anybody would listen to this podcast and say Bruce is the funny one of the two. But, you know, however you choose to enjoy it, please write us a review on iTunes. It helps get the word out. We'll see you next time.